Good evening, I'm Mitchell Krause. Tonight, Newsfront presents two Harvard professors who met last Friday with key presidential advisor Henry Kissinger. We'll hear their assessment of the present role of their former Harvard colleague. Then we talk with heart surgeon Dr. Christian Barnard about the world's first heart transplant in retrospect. But first, for a summary of the late news, here's Bernard Eisman.
Good evening. President Nixon today termed the Cambodian campaign an enormous success, and Defense Secretary Laird said the withdrawal of some United States forces has already started. Nixon made his claims of success in Cambodia during a briefing for leaders of the AFL-CIO. In his 45-minute report, the president claimed that 5,000 enemy troops had been killed in Cambodia to date, but he would not say how many American soldiers have died. Nixon did say, however, that casualties were very, very low. Following continued warnings against repeated attacks on Jewish border settlements, Israel today struck at Arab guerrilla bases along the full length of the Lebanese border. Israel's forces took several Lebanese villages, imposed curfews, and began routing out suspected guerrillas. By dusk, they were en route back to their own lines. Arab guerrillas are claiming that they're engaging the Israelis in massive battles. The Israelis say the claim is nonsense and that their casualties were only 7 wounded. In Augusta, Georgia, where National Guardsmen and police last night shot and killed 6 black men, troops with orders to shoot are on patrol again tonight. The violence started yesterday after black demonstrators protesting the death of a Negro in a local jail had paraded through town. The march was followed by rock throwing, arson, and looting by the demonstrators. Georgia officials say the prisoner had been killed by 2 black cellmates and not by guards, and that the men have already been charged for the murder. The Senate today unanimously confirmed Judge Harry A. Blackmun as an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. There was little debate before the vote. Blackmun was President Nixon's 3rd nominee for the post. 2 others, if you recall, Harold Carswell and Clement Haynsworth, had been rejected. Blackmun's swearing-in will be announced shortly by the High Court. And 5 U.S. senators took to television tonight, buying time themselves, to plump for support of an amendment to cut off funds for the war in Cambodia. The 5 are Republicans Hatfield of Oregon and Goodell of New York, and Democrats McGovern of South Dakota, Hughes of Iowa, and Church of Idaho. And there are persistent but unconfirmed reports from Washington today that some of President Nixon's advisors are urging him to take to TV in a national telethon to garner public support for his policies. Mitchell?
Since the furor over President Nixon's Cambodian decision and the ensuing events on the nation's campuses, there has been an almost daily stream of important visitors in the offices of key government officials. The president has met with students, college presidents, senators, congressmen, and governors. Cabinet members hosted delegations of former college associates, and the president's top foreign affairs advisor, Dr. Henry Kissinger, lately of Harvard, with Secretary of State William Rogers, met last Friday with a group of 12 Harvard faculty members, most of whom had served at one time or another as consultants to the government. They later announced a formal break with the administration over its Indochina policy, and 2 of them are with us tonight at the Boston studio of public television station WGBH. They are Thomas Schelling, professor of economics at Harvard, a member of the public policy program at the John F. Kennedy School of Government, former Defense and State Department consultant, and at one time a close associate of Dr. Kissinger at Harvard. And Adam Yarmolinsky, professor of law at Harvard, formerly a special assistant to the Secretary of Defense, active in the poverty program and in urban legal studies. Gentlemen, we heard of your visit on Friday to Mr. Kissinger. What was the purpose of that visit, if you had decided to make a break with the administration's policy more specific? Mr. Yarmolinsky?
Well, the purpose of the visit really was to make clear to the administration, by speaking to Mr. Kissinger, why we felt that the administration's move into Cambodia, coupled, of course, as it was, with the resumption, at least temporarily, of bombing the North, was, in our view, a disastrous piece of foreign policy, whatever its military outcome, and even putting aside its terrible effects on the country itself.
Yes, I wanted to clarify one thing. Perhaps Professor Schelling can help us clarify it. The consultancies that many of you have held in the past, are these in the past tense, or is this a continuing kind of operation? Once a consultant, always available for consultation.
some of us aren't available anymore. As to the technical question of whether we're still on the books as consultants, I think a few would rather be fired than resign.
We had a report today that Morton Halperin, whom you all know, has resigned as a special assistant to the National Security Council, and he, of course, formerly was one of Dr. Kissinger's aides. He also made a formal break. Can you not, as individuals, resign and say, effective immediately, you are no longer available for consultancy, if this be your position?
That's what I'm saying right now.
Mr. Gomolinski, is that your posture?
I think it's unlikely that any of us will be consulted, at least in the immediate future.
Well, originally, the reason I raised the question was that in the original report of the visit to Washington, it implied that many of the individuals in that group were presently, on occasion, acting as consultants, perhaps not publicly, but privately. And I wondered whether this status would continue at all.
I would suppose that it would not continue. I think in the case of all the people who were present in Washington on Friday.
Yes. Tell us about Dr. Kissinger and your view of his role in the Cambodian operation. Was he one of the makers of this policy, in your view, Professor Yarmolinsky?
Well, I'm frank to say that our discussion with Dr. Kissinger in Washington on Friday was not really concerned at all with his role. We went to him simply because we saw him as the person whom we had perhaps most ready access to, whom we could talk to, or through whom we could talk to the administration. And the purpose of our visit really was to make our views as clear as we possibly could to the administration.
Yet you do ascribe a considerable role to Dr. Kissinger in the making of policy in the White House, do you not?
Well, I don't. We certainly recognize, I think all of us recognize, that he does play an important role. But at this point, at this juncture in history, I think we felt that what was happening was much more important than what particular individuals were involved in it.
Yes, well, Dr. Schelling, what effect do you really think that a statement that you make representing, as you do, the intellectual establishment now at Harvard will have on presidential policy? Is it simply a personal act of protest?
Well, it doesn't appear to have had a lot of effect yet. We're told, in fact, we were told on the news broadcast that we all heard together a few minutes ago, that the president considers the Cambodian affair an enormous success. I have a hunch that there are soldiers in Cambodia who at least wouldn't call it that until it's over.
Yes. Well, I'd like to get back to what I was originally attempting to draw you out on, and that is this decision-making process with regard
to... That's what
I'm
talking to. A wise decision-making process doesn't refer to a military adventure of the kind that's going on as a success. If the object is to get out by a specified date until one is out, counting chickens before they're hatched is only one more evidence that this is apparently initially an ill-considered decision. We were told by a number of senators on the Armed Services Committee that they not only had no inkling of its coming, some of them Republicans, but that they believed that when Secretary Rogers testified to them, he honestly thought it was a remote possibility and that he would give them an opportunity to react to the idea before the president committed this country to warfare in still another country. Under the circumstances, I'm inclined to think that it was an ill-considered decision as well as a potentially disastrous one. And it makes me worried not only that the effects of this will be by no means a success, even if it proves to be militarily safe in the short run, but it makes me wonder what's coming next. Evidently, the president startled us, his former Senate colleagues, and a lot of people in this country. He behaved in a startling way. Even that ambiguous question about whether bombing of the North had been resumed may have been partly designed or allowed to make clear that sudden, possibly impetuous military decisions were part of the future in store. The president continually reminds us that getting out of Vietnam depends on the good behavior of the enemy. I take it the only way he has, or the only way he has admitted that he has, to assure the enemy's good behavior, is to threaten them with some kind of awful reprisal if they don't play it his way. I hope they play it his way. I hope he doesn't even have to display the kinds of awful reprisals he has in mind anymore, and I hope he doesn't have to startle us, by us I mean the American people, and do without the kind of counsel he could get from the Senate in order to appear sufficiently impetuous to scare the other side in this war.
Yes. Well, Professor Schilling, based on your own personal association with Dr. Kissinger and his work, specifically his book on nuclear power and military policy, which was published some years ago, do you see any consistency in his views and the policy that is now being carried out by the president?
No. No, I would have hoped that Dr. Kissinger would have prevented this kind of thing. I was delighted when he accepted the position because I thought that he had the wisdom, the courage, the persuasiveness to see that this sort of thing didn't happen. If the president doesn't notice that it makes a real and permanent difference to send tens of thousands of American troops across the Cambodian border, even if they pull off the tactical mission that he has in mind for them, if he can't tell the difference, I still hope he can tell the difference between nuclear and other weapons, and I hope Dr. Kissinger won't let him make that kind of mistake or get blackmailed into a position where he's tempted to make that kind of mistake.
Professor Yarmolinsky, what kind of reception did you receive at the White at Mr. Kissinger's office, and what kind of reception from the Secretary of State? What was the meeting like?
Well, I should point out that our meeting at the State Department was not with the Secretary, but with Undersecretary Richardson, with whom we had a very full and, it seemed to me, productive discussion. We got into a great many issues and explored them. Given the amount of time we had, which was about an hour and a half, I thought really quite fully with Mr. Kissinger, because we felt that we had to be on the record. It was not possible for him, as an assistant to the president, to speak to us about the issues on the record. We fully understood that and accepted his inability to respond to us substantively, but it was perfectly clear to us that he heard and took in what we said to him and was fully appreciative of the gravity of the situation.
What is your own personal opinion, Mr. Yarmolinsky, about the posture of the various members of the administration on this issue? All the major figures seem to have declaimed a direct association with decisions of this nature on Cambodia. Who do you think was responsible for this decision and the advice for this decision?
Goodness, this is one on which I think speculation is...
But surely the decision was the president's, wasn't it?
Oh, clearly the decision itself was made by the president, as it had to be, and to what extent he took counsel. He certainly didn't take counsel with his principal senatorial advisors or senatorial colleagues, as they have indicated. In fact, they were apparently so poorly briefed on what was going to happen in Cambodia that it was necessary for Senators Church and Cooper to amend the resolution that they offered in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in order to take in activities which apparently they hadn't even been told were going to be engaged in, naval activities, for example.
Well, let me ask you both in conclusion, Dr. Kissinger is from Harvard. Would you like to see him come back now or in the immediate future or eventually? I refer to the matter of Dr. Rostow, who is now in Texas. Professor Schilling?
If we've only got a minute or two left, I'd much rather talk about Cambodia and the White House than particular people involved. It's really none of our business what Mr. Kissinger's plans are or what Harvard would do about it. And I'd like to make perfectly clear that we were speaking openly to Mr. Kissinger in order to get the message publicly to the president. And his personal involvement just wasn't on our minds.
And this was not a matter of the Harvard...
No. A lot of people have found it enjoyable to jump to the conclusion that we were talking about him and Harvard. That rather demeans the whole purpose of the conversation. He didn't talk about it, we didn't talk about it, he didn't think we were talking about that. It's none of our business, and it surely wasn't our business last Friday.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Yarmolinsky and Professor Shelley. Now from the decision-making in the White House to decision-making in the operating room, and a man who made one of the most fateful human decisions in history, the decision to go ahead with the first human heart transplant. He is, of course, Dr. Christian Barnard, the South African heart surgeon, who, with Curtis Bill Pepper, the writer, has told his life story in the just-published biography, which is called One Life. Dr. Barnard, in light of experience, do you now find that a heart transplant is a viable medical procedure?
I think it's indicated in certain patients. The type of patient that suffers from an irreversible heart condition where all other forms of treatment has failed and the patient has reached the end of the road. I think in these cases one can offer the patient a extra bit of life with a heart transplant. And one thing you can certainly do, you can alleviate the distressing symptoms of terminal heart failure.
When you say you can offer a bit of additional life, do you foresee in the immediate future the possibility of a heart transplant patient living out a full life term following this operative procedure?
I don't think that we will achieve this goal in the immediate future, because the problem of rejection is a very difficult problem to solve. It's really dampening down a very essential and necessary process of the body, that is the recognition of something that's foreign and rejecting something that's foreign. And I think that we're still a long way off to conquer this problem completely.
Are you ever distressed at the results, worldwide results of the heart transplant operation that you first performed, in terms of the what seems to be a rush by the medical profession to use this procedure?
Yes, I'm certainly very distressed in the results that's been achieved. I'm mainly distressed because I think that the lay press has given this operation has given people the idea that this operation is a miracle operation, and that heart transplant will achieve the ultimate in the treatment of heart disease. Well, this is incorrect. We knew right at the onset that the heart transplant can only palliate certain forms of heart disease, and that you cannot offer the patient a normal life. With the result that I think the heart transplant became a sort of prestige operation. All cardiac surgeons wanted to do this operation. And I think in many centers the operation was done where I think they were not quite ready to do this operation with the poor results that have been reported. I'm certainly not disappointed with our own results. We have done 5 transplants, and of the 5, the 3 patients have now survived more than 1 year. 2 of these patients are still alive, and I think this, in these 3 patients, three out of these 5 patients, we achieved what we set out to do, and that is to take people who are dying from heart disease and alleviate their suffering and prolong their lives.
You mentioned publicity and some of the media reaction, though. You have been criticized, have you not, for seeming to at times encourage this kind of publicity? And let's take.
I think that I have been, as you said, criticized many centers quite severely, but I think unjustifiably. I think that we certainly did not look for this publicity, and I think that it was unavoidable. The first heart transplant the lay public, his imagination was really stimulated.
This was your patient.
This was Waskansky, the one that's described in the book. And the lay public's imagination was really stimulated by the ability to take a heart out and transplant it in another body, and it became, of course, very interesting news. And as a result of this, it was exploited by the lay press and built up to something that it really wasn't. And as a result of this, I received a lot of publicity, and it was unavoidable, the publicity that was.
How did you first get the idea of actually performing this operation yourself? How far back in your own career did the concept of a heart transplant and one involving your skills come to you?
I think this was probably about 7 years before we did the transplant. It was interesting enough, I was preparing a lecture to give to medical students in which I was going to deal with the topic of the past and the present and future of heart surgery. And thinking about the future of heart surgery, of course, it was obvious that the ultimate operation would be to put a new heart into a patient with heart disease. I then went to the experimental laboratory and actually did this and made a small movie of this operation. And then, having done this, I could see that this was not an impossible operation and started to do research along these lines.
What were the actual developments that led to the Washkonski case?
The experience that we have had all over the world with kidney transplantations and the problem of dealing and recognizing rejection and handling rejection, this was very important knowledge that we gained. And then our experimental experience of being able to transplant the heart in an animal. I think those two factors led to our feeling that we are ready now to do a clinical heart transplant.
And as I understand it, there was almost a minute-by-minute race to who would do this first, then the procedure was
No, I don't
to
think
secure.
That's correct. No, we didn't race in Cape Town. We saw that there were reports in the papers that surgeons in this country were ready to perform this operation, and surgeons in Britain was preparing to do this operation. We were ready to do it, but I don't think there was a race to do it first. The reason being that nobody realized that the heart transplant would make such tremendous news.
How did your patient first make his appearance, and what were the exact circumstances that led to his being the patient that received this?
In our whole team, the patient is selected by the cardiologist, the physicians. He's then handed to the surgeon for treatment. When we felt we were ready to perform a heart transplant, I went to the head of the cardiac department and told him that about time we do a transplant and that he should be on the lookout for a patient. And then he came to me and told me that he had this particular man, Louis Washkonski, who we thought could benefit with this operation. And he was then brought into hospital, and I was introduced to him. I think that this whole story is described
yes,
in this.
I was trying to get you to tell us about the donor heart patient as well, and the decision that was made as to how to handle that heart.
I think the decision how to handle the donor, we acquired, or the method to handle the donor, I think we acquired that knowledge mainly by our experience we have had in this country in centers where they did cadaver kidney transplants. I worked before, a year before I did the transplant, I worked in Richmond, Virginia, where they had a very active program of kidney transplantation using cadaver donors for kidney transplant. And there I learned how to handle the donor for a organ transplantation.
Well, of course, the question with the heart is the moment of death and whether the heart is to stop
beating. We used exactly the same criteria for the moment of death that they used in this country at that stage for the moment of death of kidney transplantation. You see, the heart tolerates an absence of oxygen extremely well, and you can wait until conventional death is present. That is, an absence of respiration, an absence of cardiac activity, and an absence of brain activity before you remove the heart. And we did that in the first patient. We waited until the heart stopped beating and there was no electrical activity on the electrocardiogram before we removed the heart.
Well, do you believe that this should be the standard that should
no,
be
No, I don't think it's necessary at this stage. I think that once brain death is determined, even you still have a beating heart, the patient is dead and the heart at that stage can be removed. The point is that something that you must realize is that the heart is only beating because you apply artificial means to keep it going. As soon as you stop those artificial means, the heart will stop beating if the brain is dead.
Is there sufficient agreement as to what this state of the patient is for this procedure to go on without the inevitable challenges that come as to whether the doctor is anticipating death and not acting at the proper time?
Well, I think the patient has a very adequate safeguarding against this. In our country, the law is that the moment of death must be determined by two doctors outside the transplant team that has no interest in the transplantation. Their their job is to look after the donor and to do as much as they can for the donor to try and save his life. And they have nothing to do with the transplant. So I think that the chances of a patient being in this sort of situation that I'm describing in my clinic, the chances of a patient being declared a donor before he's dead is a very, very remote.
According to your book, you are a very religious person, and you seek divine guidance before you go into any of these transplant operations.
Well, not only transplant operations, any operation.
Yes.
I do.
Well, in this special case of the death of a patient, when you're dealing with a human life, the decision must be made in a very irrevocable way that this patient is beyond return to
life.
But
that's not my decision, you see. My decision is not to determine that the donor is dead. That's the decision of the neurosurgeons or neurologists who are looking after the patient. When I receive the donor, he's dead.
And so you don't feel involved in that decision in
any
way?
No, I'm not involved in that decision at all.
Don't you feel that there is an area, a gray area here, that under the pressures of the operative procedures, that the demand for the operative, the usable heart, can move things in the direction of premature?
I can only speak for myself and for my own clinic. I think that since heart transplants have been performed in University of Cape Town, that people have really erred on the side that they wait longer than they should wait to make sure that a patient is not presented as a donor before there is no doubt at all that he's dead.
Dr. Barnard, let me ask you in conclusion, if you would sum up for us, what effect this operation procedure that you've been involved in has had on your own life? It certainly has made you a worldwide celebrity. Has this impeded your own work?
I think it has had very good effects and it has had some very bad effects. I think on the positive side, it has... made people in my country realize the importance of research and what the medical people in South Africa can do. More money has become available to do basic research, to build better centers to treat patients with heart disease. We have attracted more scientists from overseas to come to South Africa, which you know is quite a remote and isolated country. And the local authorities have been stimulated to send more scientists overseas to go and learn overseas. We have also attracted patients from all over the world, and I think on the whole we've built a better clinic as a result of this operation. On the negative side, I think that all this publicity and traveling so widely has interfered in my ability to be at the clinic as much as I really should be there. It's also, as you've known, it's my private life has become news of everybody, and as a result of this, I think my family, especially my children, have suffered quite severely.
You don't think the coverage of your private life has been accurate?
Oh, no. You know, the type of papers who cover this are usually the papers that look for sensation, and therefore it's never accurate, the coverage of that. I mean, they write everything up as in a sensational way. But I think, on the whole, if you have to weigh up the good against the bad, then I think that... the scale will weigh very heavily in favor of the good. So I think, on the whole, the thing has turned out very well for me.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Christian Barnard, whose story is told in his book, One Life.
Thank you, sir.
Tomorrow evening here on Newsfront, we hope to examine the developments in Augusta, Georgia, the bloody riot, and the several deaths caused overnight in that troubled city. Newsfront, produced in New York by WNDT, is brought to you through the facilities of the Eastern Educational Television Network.
Newsfront is made possible by a grant from Trans World Airlines in association with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.